You're listening to Homicide Worldwide. Your hosts, Sally and Keita, would like to remind our listeners the episodes deal with crimes that are graphic in nature and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Eyeballs. They can tell you things about a person. By simply looking into the eyes of another human being, you can know more in an instant than words could ever express in a lifetime. You know when there is strong emotion, like love or anger, and you can know when a person is lying. Just like the Eagles song, you can't hide your lion eyes. When you look into the eyes of, say, a young child, who is still full of wonder and optimism, you see a gleam and a zany joy for all the possibilities of a life yet to live. The same can even be true when you look at your dog, because with dogs, there is a purity of heart that no person could ever have. Until this episode, I never thought much about eyes, other than that I'm glad to have them, or choosing which mascara to use. Until masks became a thing during COVID, I never really smiled with them to let somebody know that I'm not hostile, at least most of the time. Eyes really are quite interesting, though, when you stop and take a second to think about what they are and what they do. For one, they allow us to see the big, beautiful world around us, to look at the clouds in the day or the stars at night, to see another person and know if we want to talk with them or know if there is danger afoot. They are things of great beauty, mystery, and sometimes they are things of obsession. It has been said countless times that the eyes are the window to the soul. We've all heard that one. And let's not forget the evil eye for protection, the eye of the storm where the calm lives before the chaos begins, or the eye of the tiger when you need to be laser focused. Charles Albright had a special fascination with eyes too, that started when he was a child, learning a very unique craft under the very watchful eye of his mother. He loved all kinds of eyes. This interest that he had is thought to be the reason behind what he did in his later crimes, because he didn't just murder his victims, he kept trophies from them. He kept their eyes. This is episode 75 of Homicide Worldwide. Sally.
Hello, Keita.
So lovely to see you.
Nice to see you. Welcome, welcome. We are glad to have you with us on this little podcast that we call Homicide Worldwide.
Yes.
I am one of your hosts, Sally.
And I am your other host, Keita.
And it is episode 75.
Dude, how did we get here? This is insane.
I know, right? You know how? We kept recording episodes.
We've done 74 plus a bonus episode. And now we're here.
That's right. This is our premium content.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. So if you haven't been here before, then welcome. We're glad to have you. If you have been here, thanks for coming back. If you want to support the show, please give us a rating and a review and follow us on social media. Our handle on Twitter is at HWWP10 and on Instagram at Homicide Worldwide Podcast or Homicide Worldwide Podcast Production. And here's an overview of tonight's case. Charles Albright was an American serial killer, also known as the Eyeball Killer, and less commonly as the Dallas Ripper or the Dallas Slasher. It's always a ripper or a slasher, I feel.
Mm-hmm. It's so dramatic.
It's so dramatic. Charles targeted sex workers with drug addictions in the Oak Cliff part of Dallas. He would pick up the women and then he would murder them. All three of his victims were dumped in neighborhoods to be discovered. They were just out there in plain sight. In each case, the victims, Mary Lou Pratt, Susan Peterson, and Shirley Williams, were found to have had their eyeballs removed. Shortly after the last murder of Shirley Williams in March of 1991, Charles was arrested and charged for all three murders. However, he was only convicted for the murder of Shirley Williams. And as of this recording, nobody has ever been convicted for the murders of Mary Lou Pratt or Susan Peterson. And with that, let's just get to it.
Charles Frederick Albright graced the world with his birth on August 10th, 1933. Well, that was a long time ago.
A long time ago.
He was born in Amarillo, Texas, and he was given up for adoption at birth and sent to an orphanage. That's interesting that we don't know a lot about his birth parents. That would be a fascinating little piece of the puzzle.
Wouldn't it?
Well, the lucky family who got to adopt Charles at the tender age of 3 weeks old were Dell and Fred Albright, who lived in Oak Cliff, which is an area outside of Dallas. Charles was their only child. Dell, who was his adopted mother, told Charles that he was adopted and that his birth mother had been a prostitute.
Bravo, Dell. Way to go.
That's really useful information for a young child to know.
I know you're only three, but your mom was a hooker.
Yeah. So just put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, you'll be fine. Fred Albright owned a grocery store, and before adopting Charles, Dell had been a teacher. But as soon as Charles came to live with them, she stayed home and cared for him. Dell is kind of one of those women who strikes us more like Miss Trunchbull from Matilda than a motivating kind of teacher like Robin Williams was in the Dead Poets Society. Still, there isn't much about his relationship with Fred, but it is well documented that Dell was very, very strict and extremely overprotective of Charles, like to the point of being overbearing. And as he grew older, there was a serious Norman Bates vibe happening between these two.
What could possibly go wrong with a dominating mother?
I mean, let's talk about the dominating Dell.
Right? Let's go ask Ed Kemper.
Oh, that's right. We should go ask Ed Kemper. What happened there?
I don't know. Yeah. Got any theories?
Yeah.
Well, Dell was just so progressive. And as Keita said, so oppressive. He was very particular when it came to Charles. And one such way saw her not down with cow's milk for his growing bones. It was just not for her precious boy. And before it was the cool farm to table thing, Portlandia millennial thing to do, she was giving him goat milk for his health. Now, I do drink goat milk. I will tell you.
Ew, no, I can't do
you
it.
You know what? Here's the thing. You got to get the right one. Mm-mm. Because there's some that taste like literal barnyard floor.
I'm not willing to try it. I'm just going to stick with regular old cow milk. Yeah.
You're like, I don't want anything to do with goats.
I don't want to try it. I'm going to revert back to my 2-year-old self. I'm not going to do it. Well, when Charles got a little bit older, after he was given his morning allotment of the devil's milk, that being goat milk, he would then play the piano for about a half hour. And he did this under the careful and ever so watchful eye of Dell.
Can't you just imagine this as like a really creepy sort of like suburban melodrama where it's
100%.
Good morning, son. Here's your glass of frosty milk. Thank you, mother. Glug, glug, glug. Now off to the piano. And she just stands there with like her hands in like the Von Trapp family singers.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yep. Just staring at him while he like his back is ramrod straight. A little milk.
Ramrod.
A little milk still on his upper lip.
Yes. And you know, he's just sitting there and he's just thinking to himself, don't fuck up. Don't fuck up.
She'll make you drink more.
It was said that Charles was a very bright and intelligent child, so much so that he was able to skip 2 grades and he graduated at the nimble age of 15. That's pretty impressive.
That is impressive. Skipping 2 freaking grades. Damn.
Yeah. But before we get ahead of ourselves and he's just way too impressive to believe what came later, There are a couple of things that happened before he was the OG Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser. So when he was a mouthy little baby, he chewed a tape measure. And naturally, he needed to learn just how unacceptable this was. And so in order to teach him a valuable lesson, Dell locked Charles in a dark room where he could ponder his mistake for hours.
He was a baby. He was a fucking baby.
He's a baby.
He's not thinking about that.
Right, exactly. And if there's any of you out there who are like, I don't know, I think that's probably a good idea. I mean, how else is the baby supposed to learn? Okay, not by locking them in a dark room. That just makes them terrified.
For the record.
Just for the record.
Yeah.
And as a toddler, if he refused to nap, Dell would tie him down to the bed. Mm-hmm. And as he got older and more mobile and rambunctious, he would, quote, escape, end quote, from the family yard like an untrained husky, and also much like a dog. She would answer back with tying him to the porch with rope.
I mean, I feel like there are protocols in place for adoptive parents for a reason.
You would hope so. I mean, this is really way back when, though. Like,
I'm just thinking it, these people are the reason that those protocols exist.
Yeah, this is very true, isn't it?
Why good people have such a hard time with adoption. This bitch was like just picking them out at the orphanage. I'll take that one.
Right. This is going to be called Charles's Law. Yeah. Don't tie your child to the porch.
Exactly. But it's shit like this.
I know, right?
You know, has made things have to be the way they are, unfortunately.
It's true. It's very true. Also, just think about the time right now. So it's like 1933 he was born.
Yeah, see?
So the Great Depression started in 1929.
Yeah.
You don't really know what deprivation and shitty situation is until you see what happened with the Great Depression. It was all over the whole world, and it was about 10 years long, but it started with this massive stock crash called Black Tuesday. So 1933 is smack dab in the middle of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Things were super shitty. Nobody had jobs. Like, international trade fell by like 50%. Unemployment in the United States was 23%.
That's insane.
Isn't that insanity? And even things like crop prices fell by like 60%. So farmers were like poor, but like, he was born into this situation, right? His parents were almost certainly affected by it, which is likely why he was given up for adoption, because like, nobody could afford a child.
That's kind of what my thought was when I saw what year he was born. And I was thinking back to the time, and I kind of considered that as well, that, you know, who knows, maybe this was just a couple or a single mom. Who knows what the situation was? Probably people who were ill-equipped, mm-hmm. like you said, to take care of a baby during these really horrific times. Mm-hmm.
And talking about prostitution, like, in times of great privation, as in like post-World War II Europe, when you have nothing else as a woman,
you got one thing.
You got something. And this is a way that is very, very common that women are forced into. And I want to make very clear that it's a forced situation where you are just like, you have no other choice to make money if you want to put food in your mouth or your child's mouth.
Yeah.
But saying that his mom was a prostitute in 1933 was not necessarily singling out a very small amount of the population necessarily.
No.
There was a lot of people who are forced into very dire circumstances.
For unknown reasons, Dell would dress Charles in little girls' clothes from time to time. Specifically, this would happen whenever his aunt would come over. And it was during these visits, especially, that he was only given dolls to play with. But here is a good disclaimer for everybody, because you guys, you know, we shouldn't have to say it, but, you know, you guys know that, of course, we're not suggesting a boy wearing girls' clothes and or playing with dolls has any influence on the way Charles turned out, with him being a killer and all. But we do have to admit that this is an extremely curious part of his childhood. And that's because it was Dell who was forcing him to dress up, and not his choice or him asking for this. At the time, like, he was probably playing with, I don't know, guns and bows and arrows. And then she was like, oh, nope, your aunt's coming over. You're going to wear a dress. And he's like, the fuck?
Right, exactly. The fuck? The four-year-old dude.
Yeah. Dell also had a very big phobia about Charles being dirty. I mean, kids get dirty. Kids get dirty. It's a thing. This is what happens.
Like, they get dirty when they open their eyes in the morning.
This is what happens when you're a child. You're like instantly dirty. And so she didn't ever want him to be dirty, like ever. She was absolutely obsessed with cleanliness, and to the point where she would make Charles change his clothes multiple times a day in order to keep him clean.
Oh, jeez.
Quote unquote clean. And it's if that was not enough, Del peppered in a little psychological warfare on the young Charles. This was love in the time of polio, and she would force him to go to hospital wards that had people who were in iron lungs. And she would tell Charles that this is how he would end up if he wasn't careful or chose not to listen to her.
Wow. So educational.
Fucking crazy bitch.
She is nuts. And it is not right.
Oh my God.
None of this is acceptable.
No. When I started looking into this and I was researching this and I'm like, man, certainly nothing excuses what he did later in life, but that type of parenting is just, there's like not even a word for it. Like to call it abuse is kind of just an understatement.
Yeah. Well, as though Del could not be any more cringeworthy, she was way too open and often told young Charles about Fred's insatiable sexual appetite and Fred's proclivities, which included, but were not limited to, grabbing at his wife every time he caught her standing around in nothing but a bra and undergarments.
Hey, baby!
Well, Del cautioned Charles not to be like that with women when he grew up. Apparently, Fred could not get enough of the nookie, and Del was tired from all of the child rearing that she was doing.
She's like, just swatting him away all the time. Well, people who knew Charles as a child remember him as a smart boy who excelled at many different things. Under Del's reign, Charles learned to speak 3 additional languages outside of English. Oh yeah, you know, I'm freaking quadruple lingual. Well, I can't even say that in English. Later, Charles was an athlete who enjoyed little football and baseball.
How American.
How American. Mm-hmm. Also, so is serial killing. So great.
It is. He was the total package. All that aside, in 1944, Charles Albright was 11 and no bigger than a weevil. Del once again showed how progressive she was, and she allowed the boy to have a gun. Because why not? What could possibly go wrong?
Nothing could go wrong there.
Yeah, we've seen that recently, you know, with people giving their children guns at age 15, and it ends up just fine.
That's us dripping with sarcasm. Don't do it.
Yep. Sarcasm. And then because she was a cool mom and not a regular mom, Del enrolled the Second Amendment-loving, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed Charles in a mail-order taxidermy course where, according to the New York Daily News, wait for it, he, quote, learned how to pop an eye out of its socket without damaging the surrounding tissues, end quote. Fucking mom of the year. Get her a sash.
Well, sources conflict on how Charles obtained the animals that he would use in his little science experiments / taxidermy. And some say that he found dead animals around the neighborhood. Don't know where they were living, that there was just a plethora of carcasses, carcai. Others say that he killed these poor little creatures himself, probably with that gun. Whatever the method, Charles learned how to take the dead eyes out of something that was very much alive at one time.
And as though Del still couldn't get any more awful, you're thinking, it's not possible, Sally and Keita.
I know. I kept thinking that as I was writing this and looking into it. I'm like, when does it end with this woman? It doesn't.
It's like she's deliberately tried to be the worst. You know what I would love to know? I'd love to know Del's history.
Oh, God.
Can you imagine what her childhood must have been like? I would love to know that. That would answer a lot of questions.
I think so.
Well, as though she couldn't get any more awful, in yet another form of complete mindfuckery, she would not pay the money for the glass replacement eyes that are generally used in taxidermy. Those are expensive. They're usually hand-painted, and they have to get them just right.
Mm-hmm. Mary and Albert Pruitt could tell you a thing or two.
Oh, yes, indeed. While Fred and Dell were certainly not poor, Dell was extremely frugal, like shove a lump of coal up your ass and you'll get a diamond kind of level of frugal. And when it came to this part of the taxidermy process, she would have Charles stuff the socket and sew the eyes of the animal shut. And then, because it was much cheaper, she would give him little black buttons, like kind of like little domes, which were sewn over the top of the stitched lids. And it was because of this lack of glass taxidermy eyes that Charles found himself getting on a bus from time to time and going to town to shops where these glass eyes were sold. People remembered that he would touch the eyes kind of lovingly and was obsessed with the iridescent gleam of the eyes, but he was never able to buy them.
Oh, God, it just makes your skin crawl.
Yeah, this whole story is, it's so creepy. It's creepy in all the gross ways that I really enjoy.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you like it. When Charles began to date girls, Dell was his personal chauffeur. Isn't that nice?
I'm sure that went over real well with the ladies.
And not at all awkward.
It's not awkward at all. No, certainly not.
No, Yep, his mom drove he and his female companions around, and he was under strict directive, as well as mother's watchful eye. Do not try anything untoward.
Mother's watchful eye.
Don't do it. Dell went so far as to get on the horn and called Charles's date's parents to reassure them that her son would in fact be behaving himself while he was out with their daughters, as though this was something that just wouldn't be already expected.
Can like, you imagine?
Just so you know, I mean, I'm just going to make sure that he's not going to do anything. I would be like, you're not dating my kid.
Like, creepy lady.
If your mom has to call and tell me that her son is going to be okay on a date with my daughter, then the answer is no. Sorry.
Yeah. That should be a baseline given.
That's just a hard no for me.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I'm not in that position where I would have to do that. But at the end of the day, yeah, that would be a hard no.
Can you imagine that phone call? Oh, my God.
Yeah, I can't imagine that phone call.
It was during these sensitive, nubile years that Dell was omnipresent and the only person allowed to drive Charles and the girls wherever they were going. She was so controlling that she would not allow his father, Fred, or even the girls' parents to drive them around. Well, it's hard to know if Dell was overprotective because she was worried about Charles and his well-being, or if she wanted to control him like a wee little marionette doll. Yeah, what do you think, Kita? Probably more the latter.
Yeah. I also had another thought that maybe she was worried about what his behavior was like if she wasn't around.
There is that. Like, you know? She just might have had a little hunch or two about her son based on her very intimate experience.
Oh, God. God, that Norma and Norman Bates thing. It's, if you ever watched The Bates Motel, which was a fantastic series, I loved it.
It was spectacular.
I cried in the last one because I was so sad that it was over.
Me too. It was so glorious.
It was glorious. But that was the vibe I got with these two.
A little closer than close.
Like a little too close, dog. A little too close. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're telling your son about the sexual shit that his dad does with you, you have crossed a line.
It's not good. That's a big line to cross.
Hard pass.
Before Charles was groomed into the perfect gentleman, when he was 13, he was already turning into a petty thief, and that little shit was also arrested for aggravated assault.
Huh.
Yeah. As we said, the boy genius graduated high school at aged 15, after which he enrolled at North Texas University in Denton, where he expressed an interest in training as a medical doctor and, wait for it, a surgeon. What?
It was so surprising.
I know, shocking. But he was expelled his freshman year for being part of a student burglary ring. Police caught him with stolen petty cash, along with two handguns and a rifle. Naturally, Charles denied everything, but he still got the boot.
And Dell, true to form, tried everything under the sun to get the charges dropped. She went so far as to offer to reimburse the store owners for the value of the stolen items, to which they said, "No, ma'am." Then she tried to act as Charles's lawyer in court.
Always goes well.
"I'll defend my son. It'll go well. I'm sure. I'll
win." Yeah. Yeah. It did. It went great.
Oh, yeah. And in a super strong closing argument, she simply begged the judge to let her serve the prison sentence in Charles's place.
Like, come on, Del.
And the judge was like, "Look, you old bag, the answer is Texas." And with that, Charles was off to prison for a year.
Bye.
After he got out of prison, he attended Arkansas Teachers College in Conway, Arkansas. Because this is a person that you want around kids.
100%. He should shape young minds.
Yeah. I was having a thought about the taxidermy. It is a very odd little hobby to pick for a child.
Isn't it? Like a mail order taxidermy?
Unless you have noticed your child having maybe a particular interest in dead creatures and you kind of want to channel it in a healthy direction.
Like a little Dextery. That's not the worst theory.
That makes a lot of sense. When I think about being a surgeon, the amount of skills there that overlap with things like surgery are obviously you can be a lot rougher because you don't have to keep it alive, but there's a lot of overlap there.
Well, Charles is finally away from the all-seeing Dell and her oppressive influence. And for a hot second, Charles actually seemed like he was going to thrive. He was on the football team, he was in a fraternity, and he was even elected president of several extracurricular clubs. He probably even went so far as to drink some cow's milk.
Forbidden fruit.
The forbidden fruit must be tasted, just like Buster with juice. There were some good times as well as bad times for Charles, and people knew him as a real joker. Mm. One of his greatest hits was stealing a physics test key from a professor's office, then making copies and returning it before the professor finished teaching his class. I don't quite understand how that worked out, but cool.
As you were reading that, I was picturing in my mind that gif of Leonardo DiCaprio from Django Unchained, where he's like,
"Oh yeah,
like he's made such a good fucking joke."
Another one of Good Time Charlie's pranks before he got kicked out was when his roommate and this roommate's girlfriend broke up. The roommate, as you do, threw out all of his ex-girlfriend's photographs.
So we like to think of it as the roommate dramatically kind of swept all of that into the trash, letting out a deep primal scream and followed things up with like periods of like sobbing and just like crumpled in the shower. However, it happened that Charles proceeded to fish those photos out of the trash and cut out just the eyes of the girl from every single photo.
Not weird at all.
Mm-mm. And then he took it to the next level and he taped the cut out eyes all around the house and also, in a super classy touch, in school urinals.
Wow. You know that, Charlie. So quirky.
He's just so quirky.
He's just a clown.
He's just a joker. He's just a jokey jokester. It's nothing weird.
Yeah. Yeah. He's so funny.
Not weird. It's not weird if you say that you're a joker.
Mm-mm.
It's also really reassuring to me to know that people were just as batshit crazy in the past as they are now.
Yeah. Just in weirdly different ways.
That's right. Old timey ways.
Old timey crazy. Well, Charles couldn't help but be terrible no matter how funny he was or wasn't, and he was expelled once again after, you guessed it, stolen items were found in his possession. This time, however, he was not prosecuted.
Lucky him.
Yeah.
Well, Charles was just slithering all around, and he even married his college girlfriend, Betty Nestor, who was a real teacher and with whom he had a daughter. They separated, and then they divorced in 1974. But great job with carrying on your genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Very well done.
After he was expelled from college, Charles needed to figure out what his next move was. And apparently, since he was a doctor at nothing else but forgery, he created both a bachelor's degree and master's degree from, you guessed it again, stolen documents. He falsified his credentials, and they were good enough to be believable. Charles Albright, then 36, and using those forged credentials, did enter the scholastic world and was a biology teacher, albeit grossly underqualified. He landed a teaching job at Crandall High School in 1969, and in the age of limited background checks, it was extremely easy to fake your way through, at least for a while.
Hiding in plain sight, as so many of them do, he was even a backup football coach who was known to carry a victorious Crandall High player from the field from time to time after winning the game.
Could you imagine? Gatorade being poured all over him.
Sticky, sticky, sticky. Regardless of real or forged credentials and that gridiron charisma, according to Texas Monthly Magazine, Charles Albright's students found him nothing short of fascinating.
It was said that Charles could recite in flawless Latin, just one of the many languages he picked up as a kid, the scientific name for every plant that he came across. And legend has it that he could split open a rotted log and talk about each insect that he found inside. I mean, yeah, I guess you probably could talk about it. I mean, you lie your way through everything else. Like, why wouldn't you lie about some fucking insects?
A regular David Attenborough.
I mean, honestly, though, you know, I mean, who cares if you can talk about a fucking beetle?
Right, exactly. You know, except for the murderous tendencies, he probably could have been a really cool guy. I mean,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but there's that.
Well, you know, in the prime of his life, he was pretty hip, and he even drove a green Corvette, and he wore lizard skin shoes to school. He was considered something of a smoke show, if you will, to the young girls crazed by the internal chaos brought on by the dawn of womanhood. Several of these young ladies were so smitten, in fact, by his charm and manly looks that they would write him love letters.
Well, those lizard skin shoes, man. A girl can't say no.
I would be stoked on a pair of lizard skin shoes myself. Just saying.
For yourself, though, but on a gentleman?
I feel like for the time, it wouldn't be bad.
I guess for the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Charles continued his life of fraud by forging checks and somehow got caught while he was teaching, but he was only placed on probation and not fired like a normal person would be.
Like you or I. And they would have like not just fired you or me. They would have just taken us out and had the firing squad open up on us.
I feel like they would have used us as an example to others.
100%. Like yeah. Life often does anyway.
Exactly. I feel like I'm just a bad example to everybody else. However, this good fortune was short-lived, and as all good things must come to their end, his faux teaching career did just that. When an East Texas State University administrator realized he had never met an East Texas State University graduate named Charles Albright.
Oh, God, at least fake your name, pal.
You're fired.
The university administration was extremely embarrassed that Charles had tricked his way into teaching at the high school by using forged documents, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
They would be. Certainly, they were bothered by the fact that he had gotten a job and managed to have some significant interaction with students as well, but they just really wanted to save face and kind of make this problem go away. And so, as anything is, when they have some people in power who can magically make things disappear, it was kept hush-hush, and the scandal was not publicized. And Charles Albright, once again, only served 1 year of probation for fraud.
Wow.
This guy was like a fucking water weenie.
Dude.
So slippery.
Yeah. Like the get out of jail free cards literally just keep on coming.
It's just like, yes, it's like a permanent get out of jail free card until it's not, though.
All right. Well, Charles was a jack of all trades, but a master of none. He was a decent con man who sucked at not being caught, but who was touched by an angel when it came to getting out of these situations. During his post-scholastic years, he wandered the earth searching for who he was. Oh, serial killer. He tried being a hairstylist.
He's like kinfolk.
He is. He's part of our clan, except for the killing part.
Yeah.
And then a baseball bat maker. That's quite a divergence.
It's a natural transition.
Right. I mean, one just flows to the other.
Right.
He even designed things for planes, like parts for planes.
Yeah.
And he even claimed that he was also, wait for it, a bullfighter at one point.
El Matador.
Toro, toro, toro. And eventually delivered newspapers and was a part-time carpenter. That's quite the fucking skill set.
I mean, I guess when you've just done it all, I mean, yeah, just, you know, do what you love and deliver them newspapers, yo.
Yeah. Hairstylist, baseball bat maker.
That's a hell of a resume.
Plane part designer, bullfighter, newspaper deliverer, carpenter, taxidermist. Jeez Louise. Mm-hmm. That's
a lot. Charles continued to commit theft, and he was caught stealing hundreds of dollars worth of merchandise from a hardware store. For this, he received a 2-year prison sentence, but we have no indication that Del came to his aid and tried to serve on his behalf this time. She's like, no, not this time, Charles. No, I'm too old for this shit.
Objection!
No matter, in the end, because Charles ended up serving less than 6 months for this offense before he was released. As though it were possible, Charles became even worse. And to be clear, in case it's not clear, we don't like him. But this is where we begin to hate him a lot.
In 1981, Charles molested a 14-year-old girl who happened to be the daughter of some of his friends who knew, or thought they knew him. The friends, it seems, trusted him to stay with their daughter while they were out one evening. When the girl's parents found out that this happened, they thought that it was better not to make a big legal thing out of it, allegedly to spare the girl. And so rather than going to trial for this, Charles simply pled guilty. And yet again, he received no jail time, just probation.
Oh my God, this guy. Some years later, Charles claimed that he was completely innocent. And he said that he had pled guilty to avoid what he called a quote-unquote hassle.
That's not a thing, asshole. No.
People don't do that.
That's not how it works.
If you're not guilty, you don't say you're guilty.
Just to avoid the hassle of...
A hassle?
The hassle of what? Being found not guilty? No, I fucking idea.
The hassle of being an idiot.
Right.
In 1984, Charles applied to be a leader in the Boy Scouts. Identitator!
Jesus.
But he was rejected due to his penchant for young girls and a lengthy probation period. And then Charles met a woman named Dixie, lucky lady, in 1985. He invited Dixie to live with him, and soon she found that she was his sugar mama. That's so nice. And as any respectable man does, Charles let Dixie pay his way, his bills, all of the shit that he incurred, and he let her support him while he had his dream job of delivering newspapers.
Well, after bullfighter doesn't work out, what's your next step?
I mean, the world is your oyster, Charles.
It really is. Your rotting oyster. By the late 1980s, Fred and Del Albright were dead, and Charles had whipped up a long criminal history of theft, forgery, and now, everyone's least favorite crime, child molestation. He worked from time to time, but he often had no job. And thanks to Fred and Del coming in clutch and dying, he lived off the inheritance they left, which included income from several rentals in the area. One of the tenants in these homes was named Axton Schindler.
Now, as we like to do around here, we're going to just take a quick little look at what life was like in Oak Cliff, Texas in the 1990s. While it's a pretty nice place now, it was not so nice about 30 years ago. Oak Cliff, which is just outside of Dallas, was pretty run down and not a great area at the time. It had lots and lots of crime and lots and lots and lots of drugs. At the time, Dallas was experiencing a record number of murders. On average, it came out to about 2 a day. That's a lot of fucking murder.
Yeah, it's a lot of people.
Drug-addicted sex workers were all over the place. And police have described the women by saying, quote, they aren't the high-priced, pretty call girls, end quote.
Oh, fuck you, assholes. What a thing to say.
It was a really interesting way of putting it, I thought, too. I'm like, that's fucked up.
It's one of those things where it's like, that says more about you than it does about me. But in this case, it really does.
Yeah. I think what they were referring to, certainly not to defend them, I think what they were referring to was the drug addiction.
Yes, that's very true.
In that regard.
Yeah.
And it was the height of the crack epidemic. And most of the women who worked in Oak Cliff had up to 20 Johns a day.
Oh, no. Yeah. That's not helpful for your body or mind.
Right. Many of them would actually do a thing that they call a flat back, which, in case that's not clear, it means that it's full-blown sex with each of these men. And these guys were not exactly class acts either. And many times the women would be physically assaulted as well as the other terrible things that they had to endure throughout the day just to get the fix for their addiction. It's definitely cleaned up from what I could tell. I was trying to find information out about it. And it seems like, you know, every area everywhere has an area like this, right? And so in our area, it's definitely a lot better than it was 30 years ago. It still needs some help. And Oak Cliff is the same way. It's getting better, but it certainly isn't what it was in the 90s, but it's definitely better than it was then.
Yeah.
And now that we have that beautiful mental picture of what Oak Cliff, Texas was like in the 90s, this takes us to our first murder.
Mary Lou Pratt was born in 1957. There's very little information available on Mary Lou Pratt, other than the details around her murder. Some sources say that she was a mom, and that she loved her family, and that she desperately wanted to get out of prostitution. She was 33 years old when she was found beaten and murdered on the morning of December 13th, 1990. She had been shot in the back of her head by a .44 caliber gun and dumped in the street in front of a house, wearing only a shirt and bra and no pants, her body purposely positioned in a very undignified manner, the details of which we do not need to get into.
Most theories suggest that Mary Lou Pratt was left on the street with many homes so that she would be easily discovered, as though the killer wanted people to see his work. Dr. Elizabeth Peacock was the medical examiner in Mary Lou Pratt's case. As she went over the body to determine the manner of death, she went to look at the condition of Mary Lou Pratt's eyes. As she opened the eyelids, she found that both of Mary Lou Pratt's eyes were missing. And not like they were gouged out missing, the removal was done with surgical precision. So cleanly, in fact, that there was no trauma to note from the outside, like her lids weren't bruised. In Mary Lou Pratt's case, there was an eyewitness, a woman named Veronica Rodriguez, who told the police what had happened.
On the night of December the 12th, 1990, a man approached Veronica and Mary Lou Pratt about a three-way. They were like, fine, okay, bro, let's get it over with. And they got into the man's car. He drove them to a secluded field where they parked, did their business. And after it was over, the man got increasingly angry, aggressive, and then violent towards the women. Veronica claimed that after this interlude, she put herself back together only to be hit with what she believed was a gun. And she said that she briefly lost consciousness, but claimed that she came to pretty quickly and saw the man shoot Mary Lou Pratt in the back of the head.
Veronica got the hell out of there. And this part is a little unclear with exactly what happened next with regards to her getaway. Some sources say that she took off running and that she had hid in a drain pipe that she found in the field until the man who shot Mary Lou Pratt left after he was unsuccessful in finding her. However, most sources say that Veronica ran and that she saw a house, that she ran up to the house and banged on the door, and a man answered and let her in. And that man was Axton Schindler. Police initially blew off everything that Veronica told them. And while it's shitty that they did that, it was because Veronica was a woman who police were very, very familiar with. She had been a longtime sex worker with a lengthy arrest record and a reputation with police for telling them what they called pity lies when she would get arrested.
This time, when she was trying to get them to believe her, She described a tall guy with salt and pepper hair. She described what she saw during Mary Lou's murder and also how she fled. Veronica, like many of the women in Oak Cliff, was heavily addicted to crack, and many of her previous arrests were for drug-related offenses as well as prostitution. Unfortunately, because of all of her past lies, police dismissed her story as just that. A story from, as they put it, a crackhead whose brain was fried.
It's really so sad that is how she was perceived. I mean, at the same time, though, it was true.
Right.
I mean, she was definitely that person.
Yeah.
And it just so happened with this huge thing that she was telling the truth. And it sucks because it's kind of like the girl who cried wolf. And they didn't want to believe her, you know. And this was the one time where they should believe her. But they were like, nah.
So many times before. Yeah.
With no other leads, police half-heartedly began an investigation into Veronica's story, and during their search, investigators found no physical evidence that could lead them to anything promising, just that Axton Schindler, whose house Veronica had run to, didn't own that house. He rented it from a local man who owned several other properties around Dallas. That property owner was none other than Charles Albright, who looked a lot like the man Veronica had described. But certainly, that was not enough to bring him in on. And so, there was nothing police could do at that point to arrest anyone at that time.
This takes us to the second murder. Susan Beth Peterson was born on September 25th, 1963. Before Susan turned to prostitution, she served in the U.S. Navy. People described her as a force to be reckoned with and a total badass. Susan was 27 when she was found murdered on February 10, 1991. She was left about a mile from where Mary Lou Pratt was dumped, on the same street just outside the Dallas city limits. Like Mary Lou Pratt, Susan was nearly nude, but she had been shot three times, once in the top of her head, once in her left breast, and once in the back of her head.
When the medical examiner went to note Susan's eye color, they found that her eyes had been removed with surgical precision, and investigators realized that they were looking for what they called a repeater. The murder of Susan Peterson fell under the jurisdiction of Dallas County Sheriff due to the location of where her body was discovered. So she had been taken to the county medical examiner's office. They had heard about the murder of Mary Lou Pratt. So the Dallas County Sheriff's Office quickly contacted the Dallas Police Department in order to compare notes. Neither department at this time wanted to use the term serial killer, but it was obvious to everyone what they were dealing with, and so they just referred to him as a repeater.
Euphemisms. Now that they knew that there was this repeater out there, authorities needed to warn the community. Since most people cannot handle a situation of this magnitude without coming undone, and they did not want to potentially scare off the killer, it was quite tricky. So when they made an announcement, they kept most of the detail out of the press. But like the vultures that they are, as soon as the media got a hold of this story, a swarm of reporters from all over the globe were descending onto Dallas in a frenzy to cover the story.
Police acted and contacted the FBI to get a profile which predicted the following. The killer would have some kind of specialized training, either medical or taxidermy, which would account for his skill in removing the eyes of his victims. They were off a little on this one, but they said that he would be in his late 30s. They pegged him as athletic since he had been able to overpower his victims, and this was especially true for Susan Peterson. They predicted that he would be white, and they based this off of the fact that each victim was white and serial killers usually choose victims from their own race. They also believed that he would likely be a regular customer, possibly even somebody who the girls trusted. The fact that he had been able to take Susan Peterson led detectives to suspect that the killer had to know his way around the area and also be known to the women. Undercover agents surveilled Oak Cliff and got hundreds and hundreds of tips, but nothing useful, and the community remained gripped in fear.
The third victim was named Shirley Williams. Shirley was a woman of a certain age, in her 40s, but sources conflict on 41 or 45. Yeah, after 40, it's all the same.
Really?
Right. Shirley was found murdered on March 10th, 1991, lying near an elementary school, naked. She had been dumped in the gutter, sort of propped up against a curb. She had facial bruises, a broken nose. She'd been shot in the face and through the top of her head.
The night that Shirley was killed was rainy, and she had left with a yellow slicker. Shirley told her daughter that she would be home that night. Sources say that she had been hanging out with some friends and that they had been using drugs. And then Shirley had gotten into a car, and that was the last time that anybody saw her alive. The medical examiner discovered that, like Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Peterson, that Shirley Williams' eyes were missing. However, there were several big differences in Shirley Williams' murder when they compared them to the murders of Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Peterson.
First, Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Peterson's eyes had been carefully and precisely removed with no trauma to any part of the surrounding tissues. This is something that is not taught in medical school, since most people need their eyes and doctors tend to not remove them. So how to perform this kind of procedure is not common knowledge. In this case, the killer was clearly rushed when removing Shirley's eyes, and as a result, he was very sloppy. So sloppy, in fact, that the tip of an X-Acto knife was found broken off and lodged near her right eye socket. And this time, there was a small amount of evidence. Shirley Williams also had two gray hairs in her hand and one pubic hair on her body that was not hers.
Gross. The other difference in this case was that Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Peterson had been a little heavier set, white with long dark hair, and Shirley Williams was black. This was important for several reasons. First, it was because initially it was thought that the killer was targeting white women, since that was so far the victim type. And it was because of this very reason that many of the black sex workers did not feel a sense of concern. Secondly, it meant that the killer was switching things up and crossing some very, very big lines. It made him more of a moving target for police, since he was now not sticking to a specific type of woman in terms of age or race or shape.
Criminologists went over Shirley's body and collected even the smallest of evidence, as well as what officers picked up from the scene. Criminalist Charlie Lynch took over and, prior to the autopsy, had removed hairs from the back of Shirley's neck with tape. He identified a hair that he found as a pubic hair from a Caucasian.
Ew, God, that word.
Can we just stop saying pubic? Stop saying pubic. Oh. You stop no, saying but, pubic. Oh, no. Every time you say pubic, it drives me crazy. Pubic.
No. God, it's up there with the other one. It's not as bad. It's not as bad as my man. But...
They also identified the gun used on Mary Lou Pratt, and they found that it was the same that had been used on Shirley Williams, which was a win since the killer used a different gun on Susan Peterson.
This guy was all over the place, dude. All over the place with what he did. Well, at this point, a woman named Brenda, who is also a sex worker in Oak Cliff, told police that a few evenings before Shirley Williams was murdered, a man in a green or brown station wagon picked her up and tried to kill her. She described him as older, with salt and pepper hair and a mustache. She said that once she was in the car, the man wanted to take her somewhere to go and have sex, but she told him no. Brenda was more comfortable at a motel that she was familiar with. And at this point, Brenda said that the man became very angry and screamed, quote, "I hate whores. I will kill you all you fucking whores," end quote.
Red flag.
Brenda understood the assignment at this point, and so she grabbed the mace that was in her purse and she sprayed him. But it did little to stop him from driving. At this point, she said, "Fuck it," and she jumped out of the moving car, and he did not come back for her.
Yep.
I have to say that the women who are in this story are probably some of the toughest people.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that.
Yeah.
Just for a quick minute, like being in a car with a guy who's saying these things to you, mm-hmm. and this is already a dangerous profession, mm-hmm. and to have just that quick instinct to be like, I'm going to mace you.
Yep.
This didn't work. I'm fucking jumping from a moving car.
Yeah.
You got to hand it to Brenda.
Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And for all those out there, if you're in a car with somebody and it's driving along and you're pretty sure that they're going to kill you, you might as well jump from that moving car because you're going to die anyway. So you have a fucking chance if you duck and roll when you hit the ground.
Tuck up tight.
Get some broken bones and some bruises and shit, but you'll be alive.
Yep. But you'll be able to talk about it later.
That's right. You won't just be part of our story.
Exactly. Brenda was shown some photos to see if she could identify the man who had picked her up. And without hesitation, she identified Charles Albright.
The next step was to go back to Veronica, who happened to be easy to find since she was in jail. Yeah, that usually helps.
Perfect.
Helps it a little. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hard to get away. They showed her the photos, and although at first it was difficult to get her to cooperate, she too identified Charles Albright as her attacker and as the man who had killed her friend. Another woman named Mary Beth told the police that she knew Charles Albright. And that on December 13th, the same night on which Mary Lou Pratt had been killed, Mary Beth was grabbed by a man who put a knife to her throat, forcing her into a car and slapping her in the face. The man took her to a field where he threw her down on a blanket. In her statement, she said that the man had a case in which were sharp, pointed blades. She claims that she passed out from fear. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And that when she woke up, he was gone. Man, that lady was lucky. There's no reason that he needed to do that. If he had her where he wanted her, I wonder why that happened. Huh.
I know. It was an interesting story.
The only thing that I can guess is that somebody came along and interrupted him and he had to flee or get caught.
Yeah. I think that there's that possibility. And I think there's also a possibility that it could have been somebody who looked like him.
Oh. The knife is an interesting addition too.
Yeah, because if everybody else had been shot, mm-hmm. then a knife might be, I guess he's straying from his MO that way.
Yeah, and at this point, there's not going to be a lot of straying. I mean, he has a system that works.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that's why I was kind of taking hers a little bit with a grain of salt, but the timing was right.
Yeah.
And the statement was interesting. And the fact that she said that she knew who Charles Albright was kind of lended itself to, like, I felt maybe that she was saying the truth.
Yeah.
It wasn't just Veronica and her crazy stories anymore. And cops began interviewing other sex workers in the area. They all came out the same: a truck, a field, rough treatment, and a blanket. Then a woman named Tina showed the police the field where Charles would take her. The search turned up a blanket, some condoms, and a crumpled yellow raincoat, like the one that Shirley had been wearing the night she disappeared, and it had blood on it. Tests revealed that it had Shirley Williams' blood on it, as well as several unknown hairs. They were not human, they were not dog, they were not cat, they were not mouse, and they were not a deer. They were hairs from a squirrel, specifically from a squirrel's tail. Officers decided to dig a little deeper into Axton Schindler and maybe consider that Veronica could be telling the truth.
The Popo pondered what they had heard on the streets over the past month and what Veronica Rodriguez had told them of what happened to her that night in December. Axton Schindler was questioned and for a minute was considered a viable suspect as well. He had even stated that it was not Charles Albright from whom he had saved Veronica, but rather an unknown Hispanic male. Yeah, blame it on the Hispanics.
Yeah.
God.
I know, that was exactly my thought when I was writing that. I'm like, of course.
Yeah. Play the race card. Why not? Right? Exactly. Asshole. But on March 22nd, 1991, members of the elite tactical squad surrounded Charles Albright's home. They spotted a station wagon like the one described by Brenda, and they moved in. Something out of a movie, and windows were smashed and stun grenades were tossed inside. Others broke in through the door and roused the slumbering Albrights from bed. Charles Albright would later complain about this and ask why they hadn't just knocked. Because you're a serial killer, dude.
I mean, how impolite of them.
I know. Couldn't they have just known? That's so rude.
He's a very refined gentleman. He would never have done something like this. He speaks four languages, for Christ's sake.
I mean, he's a classy gent.
He is no savage. That's just right. Knock.
Yeah. I mean, he's not more intelligent than you. He's just better educated than you. Yeah. Well, Charles Albright, on March 23rd, 1991, was arrested and charged with 3 counts of murder.
The missus was none too thrilled, as one might imagine. Mm-hmm. Poor Dixie. She was a menopausal widow when she met Charles. And when she was questioned, she had no idea why her husband would have condoms. She's in menopause. They don't need those things.
No, ain't no baby coming out of there.
There is nothing happening. Everything below the waist is kaput. Dixie told police that she had not known of the criminal record that Charles had, and at least for a while, she stood by her man. But Charles had led a secret life, and he had been going to prostitutes for years without Dixie knowing.
For a minute, though, cops weren't so sure that they had the right guy. Charles didn't fit the profile of a serial killer. For starters, he knew several languages. Oh, so educated. And he was charming.
Yeah. No serial killer is intelligent or charming. I can't think of one.
I can't think of a single.
Nope, not a one.
A single Bundy one.
And this is, of course, certainly not a red flag.
No, certainly not a red flag at all.
Not at all. No.
And not to mention at 57, he was considered to be too old to be a serial killer.
I feel like that is age discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very ageist.
It is.
Yeah. Anybody can be a serial killer. We should all aspire. It's like the great equalizer. Anyway,
you're not too old.
You're not too old. He was apparently quite a virile 57, and he had a collection of red condoms.
Gross. Why red?
That's absolutely terrible. Neon green is the worst color for a condom.
Oh,
and
God.
Red is bad because, do you know why? It's because, I'm sorry,
the blood.
I'm very crude. When you pull your dick out, it looks like it's bleeding, okay? And it's not a turn-on for
That's
most people.
Not hot.
It's not. No. And it was the exact color of condom that had been found lying next to Shirley Williams' body.
Gross. God, I just got the chills, like a full-body chill.
Right?
And not also, COVID, but like
not
just
a COVID
disgust.
Chill, just disgust no. chill. No,
a red condom chill.
A red condom chill. And gentlemen, let the record reflect that if you are buying condoms for use with males or females, red, just no.
No. Maybe he thought it said ribbed for her pleasure, but it was really red
for her
pleasure.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It has to be it.
It has to be it. I mean, what else could it be? Well, it also came to light that Charles had previously been acquainted with Mary Lou Pratt. Mm-hmm. The vacuum cleaner from Charles and Dixie's home was taken as evidence, as well as a collection of guns that he had first denied ever having.
I don't have no guns, man.
No, they were found in a secret hiding place that he had told police about.
Well, okay, maybe I have one or two. Well, check here. Okay, maybe, yeah, check there. There might be a few.
Okay, there's an entire bunker full of guns.
Yeah, no, it's like a full-blown arsenal. Hair analysis from confiscated blankets were sent to Charlie Lynch in the lab, along with the vacuum. The blankets had hair and fibers, as did the debris in the vacuum. Vacuums are so gross, but it was so useful in this case.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that nasty-ass vacuum gave up some secrets, and they were able to isolate some of the hairs that they found inside of it, and they turned out to be consistent with Shirley Williams. Unfortunately, there were not enough strands to perform the type of DNA analysis that was used at the time. But there were squirrel hairs that were found in that vacuum. Squirrel tail hairs, to be exact.
Charles agreed to let the police take hair and blood samples from him. And Lynch discovered that hair found on Shirley was consistent with Charles Albright's hair samples. In addition, hair found on the blankets appeared to match hair from the women. As evidence was collected and people talked, one of Charles's cronies told police that Charles had once commented that he hated prostitutes and wanted to kill them. As good as it seemed, hair was considered class evidence, and it could not be proven with certainty to have originated with that particular person. Either way, on March 26th, the DA filed capital charges against Charles in the deaths of Mary Lou Pratt, Shirley Williams, and Susan Peterson.
One of Charles's neighbors had this to say, quote, "I just couldn't believe it. You know, he was a real nice person. You know, bringing souvenirs back whenever he went to vacation," end quote. That's such a stand-up guy. The trial began on December 13th, 1991, and the evidence presented was mostly circumstantial. It didn't matter because on December 18th, just a few days later, the jury found Charles guilty, but only of the murder of Shirley Williams, not in the deaths of Mary Lou Pratt or Susan Peterson. Because of the circumstantial evidence in this case, throughout the years, many people thought that Charles was wrongly convicted. However, there was never another suspect, except for Axton, who was cleared, and Charles remained institutionalized until his death on August 22nd of 2020 in West Texas Regional Medical Facility in Lubbock. He was 87. Fucker lived to be almost 90. He maintained his innocence until the day he died.
Jeez.
He was one of those.
He was one of those. There's a lot of them who the evidence is just like so overwhelming. It's so clear. It's like, how did the squirrel hairs, how did their hairs get on your blanket? Like, I'm innocent. Oh, I've been framed. It's like, come on, dude. Come on. Come on. Come on.
It was such an interesting case to me in that way with the circumstantial evidence. I mean, you know, you had the eyewitness with Veronica Rodriguez, but everything else really was circumstantial. And it's amazing to me that he was able to be convicted in any of these murders based just on that. But thankfully, with Shirley, he was sloppy because with the other two victims, he did not leave any evidence behind.
So question for you.
Yeah.
What do you think he did with the eyeballs?
I don't know because they never found them.
Oh, my God.
I would guess maybe he had a special spot where he buried them.
I'm guessing that he put them on his mantelpiece and yelled at them.
Because he couldn't yell at his mom. He was like, God damn it, Ed Kemper, you beat me to it.
Kemper style.
I really don't know because it's so interesting that, you know, as I was saying, like with the circumstantial evidence, like, you know, everything that was built around this case was just kind of based on these hairs and these fibers. And it's great that we have all that science and everything, but there was no physical evidence. Like the eyes were never recovered. You would think that that would be a literal key piece of information.
And it surprises me that they weren't recovered because he went to so much trouble to get them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like he would have kept them, right? I mean, it's like,
I really think that he probably had them somewhere sacred to him that he could go and visit them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that nobody will ever find out.
Mm-hmm.
That's my assumption.
I have also a theory about why he kind of changed his pattern halfway through so he could have green eyes, blue eyes, and brown eyes.
Oh, that's an interesting theory.
I'd love to see what color their eyes were and see if there was like an effort to make sort of like a range.
Oh, God.
Mm.
Oh, I didn't even think about that, but that's a really, really interesting thought.
Disturbing idea.
No,
it disturbs me that I came to that.
Disturbing and interesting because it's not unthinkable with him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I referred to the women in this episode as sex workers. Everything that I came across was prostitute. I even read a few articles where they referred to them as hookers.
Hookers, yeah.
And I think that those terms, even prostitute, is so disrespectful because, as you were saying, you know, it's not any little girl's dream to grow up and become a sex worker.
Mm-mm.
We all, you know, kind of hope that that never happens to us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know how these women, certainly with Susan Peterson, she was in the fucking Navy, for God's sake. You know, we don't know how that devolved.
That's right.
And how that happened. And so I made a big effort to try and be as respectful and mindful of that as possible. So, you know, calling them sex workers, referring to them by name,
mm-hmm.
and really trying to humanize them because they were people and they did have lives. And whether or not anybody, you know, agrees with whatever how they conducted their lives is irrelevant because, you know, of what happened to them and nobody deserves that.
I agree with you completely.
I'm going to get off my soapbox and let's hit them with some fun facts.
Oh, they love their fun facts.
They fucking love it.
Thank you. Well, we had mentioned that Charles was something of a painter. Back in the day, a friend of his asked him to paint a portrait of the gentleman's wife.
The gentleman.
I know, right? Months went by, and the portrait was almost, but not quite finished. This portrait was huge. It was pretty much life-size. It was 6 feet tall, 3 feet wide, detailed, and very beautiful. Everything had been painted except the eyes. Ah. Had not been painted. And the friend was like, bro, what gives? Where's the eyes, man?
Where's those eyes at, yo?
Where those eyes at, yo? Charles said that he had to get the eyes just right. And when the friend asked him when they would be done, Charles replied, when I'm ready to.
Ew, that's so creepy.
It's like you have to, like, there's going to be this emotional, spiritual preparation and the moment will just arrive. It's like almost outside of himself. That's very curious.
Yeah, he's like got to like really meditate on it.
Right. And then it will just like come to him like a muse in the night. Well, several weeks later, it was complete with eerily realistic eyes that people said were the kind that seemed to follow you from across the room.
I have a total side note story to this, which is eerily similar. My husband's great, 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 great aunt was murdered by her housekeeper. And
holy shit.
Yeah. And she was bludgeoned. You can't make this shit up. She was bludgeoned with the vacuum.
Oh, that's an awful way to die.
Yes.
A piece of cleaning equipment.
And
be eaten by a shark.
I know. His aunt's name was Thelma. And Thelma had a self-portrait done, which, motherfucker, we possess this thing. It is in my house.
Can you please send me a photo?
I can't because I refuse to look at it because its eyes motherfucking follow you from around the room. Actually, no, it's hanging right outside of my office, my podcast office.
Do you hold its stare as you move through the house?
I try to scurry past it so that it doesn't hold its gaze on me.
That's really creepy. I love that you still have it hanging up, though, despite the fact that you find it disturbing. That says
it's
a lot about your character.
So disturbing. But yeah, I'm like, fucking Thelma is looking at me again.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I'm like, she's just like watching me.
She's like the nasty patron saint of your house that like scares all the burglars away. They come in and they're like, no, fuck no, we're out of here.
Oh my God, is that Thelma?
Yeah. Oh my God. Thelma, is that you?
Yeah. So isn't that crazy? And so I know what they mean when they talk about like these eyes that sort of like follow you across the room. Like that's how this painting is. Really disturbing.
That is disturbing.
Emetophobia describes an extreme fear of eyes. Apparently this is a thing.
It's gonna suck to be a human being if you've got a fear of eyes. Sorry. Right? We're very visual for the most part.
Yeah, it's gonna really suck. Your life's gonna suck.
Yeah.
Like other phobias, this type of fear can be strong enough to interfere with your daily routine and social activities, while also being considered irrational because of the lack of any real danger.
Damn.
But it's a thing. That's a phobia.
I can imagine not much of a career in customer service there.
Oh my God, no. No. You're
like, good morning, Ma!
Kind of really be by yourself a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Well, the thing is, the whole irrational part is the whole part of a phobia, right? Like, I get scared of sharks in indoor, heated, tiled, chlorinated swimming pools. And I know for a fact there's not a shark in there, but when I get in there, my lizard brain is like, it's right behind.
Dun, 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 dun.
That's what I hear. Mm-hmm. It's the pounding of my heart, but my brain is like, no, that's the Jules music. The word taxidermy comes from the Greek words taxis and derma. Taxis means arrangement, and derma means, as you might expect, skin. And the word taxidermy translates to arrangement of skin.
Oh.
Taxidermy is not done on people. Professionally, I would say. Yeah, let's just make that clear.
Let's clarify.
All right. Okay. Officially and professionally, it's not done on people, mostly because the process includes removing skin, and a big part of the act is hiding imperfections and marks, such as seams and cuts. Since humans don't have fur, scales, or feathers to hide these things, and our skin is not so easy to preserve, it starts deteriorating quickly, and its looks are completely destroyed as they dry.
Being a woman of a certain age.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds like aging to me.
Sounds like menopausal times.
Yes. Right. Don't worry. We know what you're thinking, you disgusting listeners. And yes, of course people have tried.
Yes, of course they have. Hello.
Right? If you have thought of it, people have tried it.
That's right.
Right? There's no new thoughts left in humanity. Okay. No. We've tried everything. Mm-mm. There were numerous attempts in history with varying degrees of success to taxidermy a human. And to be clear, this is not mummification. Okay. Taxidermy is very different.
No, they're very, very different.
Right. And it's not to say that human taxidermies are impossible, but it would require a lot of work and a lot of like ongoing maintenance of the piece.
Yeah. You're going to have some like serious skin hydration happening.
You're going to have to Aveeno that thing every fucking day.
Oh my God.
Yeah. You want to rub down a stuffed human every day? Go ahead.
L'Oreal Age Perfect.
That's the one.
That's what you want.
Wow. What a hobby.
According to roadtrippers.com, this was a favorite thing that I found in this whole thing. The Wacky Taxidermy and Miniatures Museum, located at 270 South Huron Avenue in Mackinac City, Michigan, 49701, showcases taxidermy oddities and custom dioramas.
I want to go there.
I want to go there. I want these people in my life.
We need to do a homicide worldwide road trip. We just do.
According to Michigan.org, anyone from the ages of 1 to 100 will love the Taxidermy and Miniatures Museum.
What toddler doesn't love taxidermy?
What 100-year-old? What octogenarian doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
It is said to be packed with history, hoaxes, and dozens of taxidermied mice.
It's because you have to start somewhere, so you start on a mouse.
Yeah. Owners Brandon and Julie Howie make all of the elaborate scenes for their animals. Here are a couple of examples. There is a coyote playing a poker game with a fox and a squirrel, all with cigars and beers. There is a showgirl squirrel.
Of course.
There are little mice tourists in front of a little miniature Mackinac bridge. And my personal favorite, a mounted pair of deer, a bride and groom called Dearly Beloved.
But that is glorious.
Is it not?
Dearly Beloved.
Oh, so God. Good. And like the bride has like a little veil on and like the groom has like a little tuxedo thing.
What could be
it has like a little string of pearls. The girl deer has like a little string of pearls. It's
and horrific.
Amazing.
Okay, so like outside of a taxidermy oddities museum, where the fuck would you put that?
Next to fucking Thelma. Hello.
Like in my house.
Like, duh. What kind of question is that?
You're like, Martin, have you seen my red jacket? It's on the bride. Like hanging on her back. Yeah. Or you can just hanging off the groom's antlers. You can put your keys.
Anything.
Put your bag.
Anything.
Practically a coat rack, man.
So many uses.
Be used for everything.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that's it.
Regular listeners know about our obsession with obsession. How does a single feature, a single concept, gain such primacy in the mind of a person that they would kill to satisfy that driving need? In Charles Albright's case, the obsession that drove him was eyes. Like all of the killers we profile, Charles Albright's story lacks some important details. We don't know the identity of his birth parents and the circumstances and events of the first 3 months of his life before he was adopted. We're missing key moments in his childhood, those before and after events, such as the rattle of dry bones in a bucket that so entranced Jeffrey Dahmer, or the endless moment in time experienced by Richard Ramirez upon entering the home where his cousin Mike had shot his own wife, the dust motes drifting lazily in the sun-filled entranceway. There must have been events like this in Charles Albright's formative years. And formative really is the word. The circumstances of our earliest years shape us forever. We like to imagine that we've left our childhood behind, but it's always with us. Our fears and dreams, our drives and obsessions, they are largely formed by experiences that occurred when our brains were forming. What happened when Charles Albright's brain was forming? What drove his obsession with eyes Why the parental encouragement of taxidermy? Why would an intelligent, capable, and talented person be driven to commit petty crimes again and again, escalating slowly throughout his life until in his middle-aged years, he arrived almost inevitably at murder? If we could answer these questions, we wouldn't just solve the mysteries surrounding Charles Albright's killings. We'd be able to answer much wider questions about how personalities form, how impulse turns to action, how interest turns to obsession, and how those pivotal moments in childhood reverberate throughout life, even to the age of 57 years old. But we don't have those answers, and even if Charles Albright knew them himself, they stayed locked inside the confines of his mind, and they died with him. For those of us without these impulses, the question remains, how do these people happen? You've been listening to Homicide Worldwide.
Hey, you.
Wanna get doomed?
I'm Tessa.
And I'm Nicole, and we have a spanking new podcast for your ear holes called Doom Generation.
Listen in as two foul-mouthed biddies have an always casual, often comedic...
What? I think we're funny.
...and sometimes chaotic conversation about the things that doomed us to be who we are today.
Take a trip with us down Nostalgia Lane, and we'll try not to veer off the road.
Available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Doom Generation Pod and on Twitter at Doom Gen Pod.
Later, Doomers!
Hey everybody, I'm Dane Holland.
It's a new STD, a sonic transmitted disease.
I'm Austin Shazam Pfeiffer.
So it would be just a smushed mashed potato situation going on in my young adolescent crotch area.
I'm Marcus Whitaker, known as I'm Electric Man.
So instead of talking about how CERN is trying to open up a portal to hell and end the entire universe, I guess I'm just going to read jokes off the freaking internet.
And I'm Austin Tiny Zen. Dr. Strange, he's circumcised because would you want an uncircumcised wizard? I don't think so.
And if you'd like any of that to make any sense whatsoever, tune in to Nerd It Through the Grapevine, a podcast where four best friends gather weekly to talk about our favorite parts of past, present, and future nerd culture every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, and whatever your favorite app for podcast is. Come join us in the Grapevine.
Okay. Sorry. Suddenly, like, my mouth is like, I'm going to produce a whole lot of mucus.
How beautiful.
Your timing is so good, mouth. Mm-hmm. You can do that in an hour and a half? Okay.
Fucking mouth.
Not going to do. Nah, no, you can't make me.
I have tried it, and I just hate the taste of it. I hate it.
Yeah. I've had some that have made me gag, quite honestly.
Yeah. Okay, that's not a good selling point. Yeah, exactly. And like a shitty crown.
Yeah, shitty crown. Like fucking some stupid, like, fake diamond. Diamantes. Charles was just slithering all around, and he even married his college girlfriend, Betty Nestor, who was a real teacher, and with whom he had a daughter. And they separated, which is unsurprising, and divorced in 1974. Wow, that's a long time since 1933. But great job.
Wait,
1974. Wouldn't it be 1947?
No, Charles is in college and he married his girlfriend in college. He's in college now.
Right. It says they separated and divorced in 1974. Wait, did I get in the wrong spot?
No.
Okay. So, wait, he would have been like... I guess that's not that far. He would have been like in his like 50s or something when they divorced.
No, he was like in his 50s when he got caught.
So like he would have been like 40. Okay, got it.
Well,
okay.
He was married. I think they got married sometime in the 60s. I didn't
find
that.
Okay, that
makes
sense. Yeah. Totally. Okay, I'm going to start this again. You're like, must we? Well, Charles was just slithering her all. Fuck my asshole.
Oh my God.
Sorry. during his post-scholastic... Oh, there's a little in there. Sorry.
Yeah.
I need to get one of those little things, but then I feel like you're just going to see this. Going to be one of those like tribes people who have the lip thing. And it's like, all oh, you see. God. Dude, I've read that the biggest one ever recorded of one of those was half an inch shy of 2 feet.
No.
Yep.
No.
Yep.
God.
Yep. 2 feet.
No.
Yep.
No, I'm trying to keep it together, not stretch it out.
I know, right? Yeah. It's the opposite of what we try to do here in the West. We're like, keep it tighter. Keep it tighter.
Yeah. Yep. Everything right. Tight.
Everything tight and young.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he was a teacher and then a hairstylist. It's like if you and I morphed and were a killer.
I know, right? And a dude who wore leopard skin shoes. I'm staying with it, leopard skin.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
fucking whatever.
I have several pairs of leopard skin shoes.
But not made of real leopards, obviously. Or are they?
I'm going to yawn.
Oh, no, I'm going to yawn. You gave it to me.
I'm going to start that over. Charles continued.
Before Susan turned to prostitution, she served in the newest Navy. Sorry, I've got a cat hair on my fucking microphone. Because there's cat hairs everywhere in my life.
Mine too.
Right? Susan Beth Peterson was born on September 25th, 1963. When removing the eyes of Susan. Nope. Shirley.
Shirley. Do you like how I capitalized removing?
I do. That's what I was going to say. When removing you the eyes, I was gonna really put it. I knew that was intentional. I knew you'd done it mm-hmm. deliberately. It's like I did with mine. Yep. In this case, the killer was clearly rushed. Charlie Lynch, one of the criminologists. I don't even know.
They had it listed as criminalists, so I just went with what they had.
I'll start over. Criminalists went over. Can I say investigators?
Whatever you want.
I like to investigate. I don't know. I don't know about that word.
Well, I mean, it listed it as criminalist.
Then I'm going to say it. Then I'll say it.
Yeah.
Well, the Popo considered what they had heard. I like the ponder.
Popo ponder.
Well, the Popo. All right. Well.
Sometimes I remember the way it was. I was so.
All right. Well, I guess that's it.